Scotia. 35 Racine, 34 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This is a banner year for women, especially here in southeastern Wisconsin, because of a couple of very important milestones. We are in the midst of a year of celebration for the centennial of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which once and for all gave women across the United States the right to vote. And for people here in the area, it's also an important anniversary year because Carthage is celebrating 150 years of women studying at Carthage. And a number of events have been planned around these dual anniversaries. One of them is later today at 6 o'clock in the Todd Weir Center. Faculty member Stephanie Mitchell is going to be having a public conversation with Woodrow Wilson visiting fellow Nancy Tate. She is the co-chair of the 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative, and before that, executive director for a number of years of the League of Women Voters of the United States. And they will be having a conversation about women's suffrage. And Nancy Tate is also going to be visiting a number of different classes on the Carthage campus over the next few days. Once again, this event today at the Todd Weir Center begins at 6 o'clock. This event is free and open to the public, although registration is appreciated. And you can do that by going to carthage.edu and click on the link for the bridge and find this particular event with Nancy Tate. Nancy Tate, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be involved.
And we should mention that as a Woodrow Wilson visiting fellow, you're going to be kept busy at Carthage over the next several days. Just give us at least a general idea of the kind of things that you are going to be doing.
I will be speaking about the centennial of the 19th Amendment in about five different classes over the course of those days. And I will be meeting separately at lunches and dinners with interested students and with faculty members, because this is such an important moment in American history, that back in 1920. And this centennial, therefore, is very important and has a lot of timely relevance to the current day. So I'm very excited to be able to share the information about it with a lot more people.
Very good. And again, your conversation with Professor Stephanie Mitchell occurs at 6 p.m. Tonight in the Todd Weir Center, and this is an event that is free and open to the public. So let's talk, first of all, if we can, a little bit about your own professional background. I've already mentioned that for some time you were the executive head of the League of Women Voters of the United States. Sketch for us kind of your life's journey that ultimately took you to a position like that.
Okay, well, I was a political science major at Stanford University, and after I moved from California to Washington, D.C., I became had several different jobs, both with the federal government, with the private sector, and then finally with nonprofits, ending up with the League of Women Voters of the United States. And the League is the only actual remaining successor organization to the suffrage movement. And so while I was at the last few years that I was at the League, and I was there for 15 years as the chief officer, it became obvious that this would be a centennial about women having a voice, an official voice, in the U.S. system of government for the first time, and it could not be ignored. So that's when I worked with a woman who was the head of the other suffrage organization at the time, the National Women's Party, and she and I created this 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative back in 2015, back before we had any idea what would happen about anything, but just knowing that the 100th anniversary of women winning the vote would be something important that we would want people around the country to know, and it is a lot of information that most people do not know.
Right. Do I remember correctly that the League of Women Voters was organized shortly after the ratification of that 19th Amendment, or was it already in the works at the time that it became clear that that breakthrough was eventually going to occur?
Yes, let me answer that in a moment, but I do want to roll back a moment to one of your introductory comments. The amendment itself was not finally ratified until August of 1920. Wisconsin, as you may know with the constitutional amendment, it has to pass both sessions of Congress, and which it took over 40 tries over the years to even make it through Congress. But then it has to go around to the states to be ratified. It had to be ratified by 36 states. So it took all of 1919, from the time it left the Congress, through like sort of last spring, May of 1919, through August of 2020, to actually get ratified, with the last state being Tennessee. It's important in Wisconsin because Wisconsin was actually the first state to ratify, which it did in June of 1919. So for Wisconsin, this has been a 100th year, but for the amendment actually entering the Constitution, the official date will be August 26, 2020, will be the centennial of that date.
I appreciate the clarification. And one probably should not minimize what a struggle that was to get those states to ratify it.
That is what I talk about on this when I visit college campuses and other venues, because it was a 72-year long, hard fight from the time they just actually started organizing. Of course, in all the years before that, women had virtually no rights either, but they didn't start actually working to get it till 1848. So it took 72 years and over 900 campaigns around the country to finally result in the 19th Amendment. Harry Chapman Catt was the president of the very large suffrage organization in the last five or so years, pushing the amendment and working in every state, organizing people and so forth. She then, actually 6 months before the amendment was actually finally ratified in Tennessee, she and her organization, which was called the National American Woman Suffrage Association, created the League of Women Voters. So the League actually was created by the suffragist organization 6 months before the amendment finally did pass.
And what was its central purpose? What did they feel needed to be done by this newly formed organization as women were about to, they hoped, gain the right to vote finally?
Well, the League has always had a twofold purpose. Initially, of course, the idea was educating women, because if you want people to do something they have never done in history, you know, you need to tell them something about it, how it works, what the issues are, who the candidates are, all of that sort of thing. So the League has always been about voter education. But the founders also knew the fight was far from over. Just having the constitutional right to vote is not the same as having all the problems in the country solved. So the League has always been involved in advocacy, mostly in good government type issues, but sometimes in other types of public policy issues. And in the early years, there's a big focus on issues relating to women and children and protections along those lines. And today, we are still doing that in over 800 leagues around the country. There's a league in every state and multiple local leagues in every state, and they can focus on whatever the issues are that are most important in their own community within the general framework of how the league operates. So at this point in time, of course, there's a lot of effort on strengthening the election system. And since different states have different laws, that can play out very differently in different states and communities.
Hmm. Before we talk about that long struggle to secure women the right to vote, I wonder if you could say a word about sort of the central mission of the 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative. What are you hoping to accomplish?
This group is mostly an information sharing collaborative. So we have a small core group of people who are all volunteers, who represent different organizations. Many are scholars. And the idea was to create a website, which we have, 2020centennial.org, where we have lots of resource materials. We have other groups who want to share this with their own organizations, have their logos all over that so that they can push it out, this kind of information out to their own members. And we have networking. So the idea is to network and share information that anybody around the country can use, be it a Girl Scout troop, a local chapter of the League of Women Voters, the state bar association in some area. It's sharing about the history and then also trying to share what other groups are doing. So we have an events calendar and so forth, and we encourage people to let us know what they're doing so other people can find them if they happen to be in the same area and join up. In addition to that, in the D.C. area, we put on about two events a year, substantive programmatic discussions that we hold at the National Archives, who actually tapes them, and these can be found on the Archives YouTube channel, where we have a series called Women in the Vote, and then we look at some of the particularly lesser-known aspects of that story, including many of the usually untold stories. And untold stories covers a wide range of topics, such as the role of money, who was funding the opposition, who was funding the suffragists. Another topic was the role of men. Men, actually, there were male suffrage leagues. Nobody ever kind of pays any attention to the fact that some men organized to help the women. And, of course, there's a number of, stories about women of color, African-American women, and so forth. So we put on programs twice a year, and they can be seen online if people are interested.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, my guest on today's morning show is Nancy Tate. She is a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow. She is visiting Carthage College for the next several days. And today at 6 o'clock in the Todd Weir Center, she is going to be engaged in a public interview with Carthage professor Stephanie Mitchell, talking about her work, that is Nancy Tate's work, with the Women's Vote Centennial Initiative. Before beginning her work on that, she was the executive director of the League of Women Voters of the United States. Nancy Tate, let's talk for a few minutes about the long, hard-fought struggle for women to secure the right to vote here in the United States, an effort which you said in some respects officially began back in the 1840s, although I'm sure before that there were at least isolated pockets of effort on this behalf. I'm curious if you happen to know in the world in general, in the mid 19th century, how uncommon was it anywhere for women to have the right to vote? I mean, was the United States badly trailing behind the rest of the world, or was in fact the state of affairs largely the same in many different places? I'm not sure how much you've even had the opportunity to study that specific sort of question, but I wonder if you know anything about that.
The United States was in largely the same position as the rest of the world. It was not at the front, but it was not at the back. I mean, there's still some countries now where there's some issues about that. Actually, New Zealand was the first country to give full voting rights to women, and they did that. It was either 1893 or 1896. And then some of the other Scandinavian countries, Australia, a few of those countries, there was a very long fight in Britain at the same time that started at least as far back as in the United States, but actually took longer to have complete fruition. So a lot of what the early suffragists, or actually the later years suffragists, learned about tactics, they learned in the British movement. But it took longer. I'm not sure why it took longer, but they started earlier and they were more aggressive, but it still took longer. So the United States was in about the middle. There were several of the European countries didn't deal with this until the 30s. So, you know, it's an okay, but not, you know, great story. The thing that's interesting in the United States is that there were states in the United States that through their own state legislatures or state using state referenda did grant the franchise to women in their states years before the federal amendment passed. There were 15 of those states, actually, by the time it finally did pass, and they were almost all in the West. So there's an interesting, you know, so that the first one really was Wyoming. Wyoming granted women the vote when they were territory, and they insisted on having that in their constitution when they entered the Union about 10 or so years later. And then the other states in the, really the whole West, California was 1911. And so a lot of historians have said there was something about more of the pioneer culture of the West and of countries like New Zealand, Australia, where you had less entrenched norms of how the world would be, that may have made it easier to see that this just didn't make any sense to exclude women who were doing pretty much a lot of the same work as men and not even let them have any say-so. So I think you can see some parallels, but it's certainly, in general, it's, you know, it took a long time for women around the world to be fully represented.
Right. As far as that effort is concerned here in the United States, of course, one of the most important events took place in Seneca Falls, New York, at some point, I believe, back in the 1840s. And it is a woman whom every American should know her name. And, of course, some people do know the name of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But she is, of course, one of the first really critical workers in this effort. Tell us what is most important for us to know about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and how she became one of the first movers and shakers in this movement in its earliest days.
Sure. Well, she was the daughter of a lawyer, and she was very interested in the law, and she would sit with her father and read his law books. And he always told her, well, it's just too bad that you're not a boy because you're never going to get to do any of these things. But sure, you can sit over here and read my book, but, you know, you're not going to get to do it. So she grows up, she gets married, and both she and her husband were active abolitionists, as were almost all of the early suffragists. And so they were working in the North, in this case in New York State. This is, of course, years before the Civil War, and there were international conferences about abolition, and they attended some representing the United States and going to London. And even though she had been active, and so was another woman named Lucretia Mott, they were not allowed to be seated as part of the delegation because they were women, and that made them mad. So when they came back, Elizabeth Cady Stanton called for the and she lived near Seneca. She lived in Seneca Falls, New York at that point. She called for this conference, and it was in July 1848, and she wrote herself something that was that she called the Declaration of Sentiments, and she outlined it and organized it along the same lines as the Declaration of Independence, sort of pointing out a number of injustices against women, including having no rights over their own children, having no rights over their property, all of that. And the very last item she had was, you know, the not having the right to vote. And when much larger number of people, both women and men, came to this convention than had been expected, and they voted on these things. And one of the only ones that was not, 100% unanimous was the right to vote, because that was seen as so radical, they just weren't sure that they could, take that on at that point. So she was absolutely fundamental. She then, shortly thereafter, got to know another woman who's maybe even better known in U.S. history, Susan B. Anthony, who was actually not at that convention, but the two of them became partners for the rest of their lives, partners in the sense of on the suffrage side. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who had multiple children, I think maybe as many as seven, stayed at home in Zetico Falls, New York, and wrote a lot of the intellectual construct for the movement. And Susan B. Anthony, who was single, traveled around the country and was a very visible presence going all over, to states, to legislatures, to courthouses. So the two of them were the most prominent people in the, from like 1848, and they both died in the early 1900s. It's important to say, though, that these were not the only women, and not all women in the movement not all people were women, and they were not all white. So some of the other important activists in that first half of the movement, one was Frederick Douglass, the well-known abolitionist who attended this convention and was an active spokesman about women's suffrage till the end of his life, which was like in 1898 or something. And so Gertrude Truth was also a suffragist as well as an abolitionist. So these players all played a very important role. They were all had passed away, however, by the time we get into the last, first 20 years of the next century. So it actually took three generations of suffragists to move the ball from 1848 through to passage in 1920.
One of the most interesting things you just outlined was at this event in Seneca Falls in 1848, where Elizabeth Cady Stanton presents this declaration of sentiments. It's so interesting to me that it involved a number of issues, and giving women the right to vote was just one of them. I'm curious what your sense is in terms of how it was that the right to vote ended up being, in a sense, the issue of paramount importance. Was it thought that that could be a gateway for achieving success with these other issues? Or just how was it that matter of the vote ended up receiving the primary attention?
Over time, over the 40 years after the Civil War, of course, American society was changing. There was more industrialization. There were more obvious issues. And so there were a number of other movements as well. And one was the temperance movement to restrict alcohol, which was seen as a major problem in lots of areas, but particularly because mostly it was the men who were drinking and spending the family's money or coming home and, beating everybody up. So there's a very large temperance movement. There was the beginning of the labor movement, but slowly a lot of the women, and of course, again, men as well, could see that they needed more power. If nobody ever was accountable to you in the election system, you didn't have nearly as much leverage to get any of these other issues addressed. So even though those issues had their own leaders and so forth, there was a lot of channeling that energy into we need the vote and we need a constitutional protection for the vote. Because as I said earlier, some states already had allowed women to vote, but it was by state law. And as we know, laws can be changed, and so your protections are a little bit iffier than if it is guaranteed by an amendment in the U.S. Constitution. So, yes, trying to move forward on other social issues was one of the things that drew many different groups together. But a number of the suffragists just believed in equity. We just don't see why, when we're all here in this country together, were denied basic rights. And so some of the arguments were just on basic rights, but a lot of them were in the context that other issues need to be addressed and sort of in a cleanup kind of sense. We need to clean up and fix things, and we already know that women are good about cleaning up and fixing things in their sphere. So maybe once their voices are heard, you know, we can see some other improvements.
Hmm. As I think of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, they're just two of the people who worked very hard on this issue, but of course they were the two who were best known over the longest span of time. They are such an interesting pairing. They are, in some respects, quite dramatically different from one another in appearance, in lifestyle, and yet apparently were very able partners to one another in this effort. I wonder if you could speak to that pairing of Mrs. Stanton with Susan B. Anthony and what kind of difference you think that made in terms of the ultimate success of this effort.
Well, yes, it was a very good pairing. They had, like-minded goals, like-minded sense of what the strategy would be, because the strategies did change over the 72 years about how you would go about getting these rights. So they had a similar orientation to what should be done, because like in any movement, some other people didn't agree and would kind of break off and have taken different set of strategies and so forth. They had a similar vision, but they had very different but complementary skills. So it appears that Elizabeth Cady Stanton was perhaps I don't want to say she was a better thinker, but she was maybe just more intellectually inclined to craft how to marshal the arguments and to write things down and to be very persuasive. But she did have lots of children, and she stayed home most of the time. She did go to, you know, meetings, but she could not be on the road speaking. And, of course, back at this period of time, there was no communication technology except newspapers and going and giving a speech someplace. And so Susan B. Anthony, who was single and had no children, traveled the country relentlessly. I mean, wagons, buggies, trains. I mean, she went everywhere. So she was a very forceful speaker, and she was willing to test things. She actually went to vote herself in a little bit later period, just to test the system, because it was illegal for her to go to vote. And so then she got arrested, and so she challenges the system. So the two of them, again, the kind of person who can stay and write and think and strategize, and the person who's out there spreading the word indefatigably, was a very powerful twosome. They, as I mentioned, had already passed the scene, but by 1915, you had two other very strong and very different, but again, complementary in different ways, leaders that brought it home, basically. And one was Carrie Chapman Catt, who, as I said, headed the largest suffrage organization. Susan B. Anthony had turned the running of that organization over to her. It had millions of members around the country. And Alice Paul, who was a younger woman, had been in Britain, had seen the more radical techniques of the British suffragists, and formed a breakaway group in about 1916, 1917, called the National Woman's Party. And that was the group of women who picketed the White House with signs addressed to President Wilson saying, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty?" So these two women did not get the first two women we've talked about got along great. They were friends. They're just their skills were different. Carrie Chapman Catt and Alice Paul did not get along personally, and their strategies were quite different, but their end goal was the same. And it's the same kind of thing where you need different strategies. In that case, Alice Paul playing what could be called today the outside game, and Carrie Chapman Catt's now saw playing more the inside game, if you want to use that language. All of that was necessary. The one bringing attention to the American public of these injustices to women, and then Carrie Chapman Catt and NALSA actually organizing on the ground, lobbying, and getting all these state legislatures to pass it. So it was another two leadership. I mean, there's millions of people, really, but these two key women, again, a kind of unusual, in their case, they did not consider themselves partners, but they did share the same goal, and their work together is what made it all succeed.
Hmm. In the face of very fierce opposition, I wonder if you could say a word about the kind of opposition that all of these women, and for that matter, the men who were working on this cause as well, were facing. Generally speaking, how was this possibility received by the male public in general, and what kind of arguments were being offered to turn this effort aside? That is, how was the status quo being defended?
Well, there was a lot of different sources of opposition, so who were all referred to as the antis. So, of course, one of them, they start on the foundation of the fact that men's roles and women's roles in society, particularly in the years after the American Revolution, had been very, strongly defined. The men's role is to be out in public, in jobs and speaking in politics, and women, take care of the home. So you do have a social notion of how things are supposed to be, as was true, around a lot of the world. So you need to change that, and there were, but as I'd mentioned before, some things are changing. Women by the 1890s and so forth need to start working and so forth, and so it's eroding in general. But there was active opposition, and one of the things that I think not enough people realize is how much organized money went into fighting against the amendment. And the principal industry who was against women's suffrage was the liquor industry, because so many women had been involved with the temperance movement, which eliminated the sale of alcohol, that the brewing industry, the manufacturers, the bartenders, they were strongly opposed. And in a lot of states, by the time, and of course it was only men who could vote, and if they go to their friendly bar, after work, and you hear how, the whole society will be ruined if women are, allowed to come and vote, they had a lot of influence. There were also a lot of manufacturers who relied on child labor. They did not really want women to vote because, who knows, those women might vote to, have some laws that would minimize that. A lot of the old-time political power establishments, particularly in the big eastern cities and midwestern cities, were not supportive. They were against women getting the vote because it was uncertain what women would do. And they kind of liked the structure the way they had it. So the Tammany Hall type arrangements, this is too much of a wild card. We don't know what women will vote for, so let's just not let them in. But actually, the Tammany Hall machine did change its mind and supported the amendment when it was up for a referendum in New York State in 1917. So once that dam broke, that had a big impact. But a very large source of opposition was also the white Southern establishment. The South, of course, we were in the Jim Crow era by then, and they were strongly resistant to enfranchising black women. So all of these things are playing out differently. They all used, so these were the real things that were going on. They used the language about how much this would undermine society. Lots of ugly cartoons and ads about, highly emasculated men, with crying babies sitting in the corner and the pots are boiling over and all the women are portrayed as, big thick glasses and, hair buns and, with umbrellas, hitting them over the head. And You know, so they used the former social norms as the argument, but really they had their own vested interest. But in fairness, there were, there were women who were actually actively opposed as well. So there weren't as many of those, but there were some, and they were active. They did have some organized, active anti-groups of what was actually white women, but, you know, they were spread around the country. So there were a lot of sources. I think that's what's interesting. That's one of the things that's interesting to talk about when I'm on college campuses or elsewhere, is to see that almost nothing happens when there's a social movement. Somebody doesn't like it about something, you know, and what are the sources of opposition and what are the strategies to try to deal with those? And the suffragists had to deal with all of that.
Right.
And they were viciously attacked.
Yeah. I mean, as we think about the opposition that they faced from various corners, and sometimes very well-funded opposition and often mean-spirited opposition, I mean, it's sort of a wonder that they ultimately were successful, and one even more deeply appreciates their grit and determination, their perseverance. And even in the case of, for instance, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, who at some point had to begin to realize that they would not live to see the ultimate fruits of their labor, and
right.
yet carried on tirelessly.
Absolutely. The first generation, as I said, it took three generations, and the first generation was completely gone. And many members of the second generation were gone. One of Elizabeth Cady Stanton's daughters was very active herself. But it really took the third generation, led by, as I say, Carrie Chapman Catt and Alice Paul, but involving many others, including anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells. It took a whole different group to really make it happen. And, yeah, it took an amazing amount of grit and endurance and willing to what you could say could be called the long game.
Mm.
And to just stick with this till it gets done.
Mm.
I think that's a very important lesson at any point, but maybe it's worth hearing in our own era because we're so much more used to with social media and everything. It moves so fast, and we can hardly keep our head straight about how fast things change, that sometimes you just have to stick it out. You need to endure. You need to focus on your goal and keep working, even though it's tough. And it was tough.
We're speaking with Nancy Tate, who is co-chair of the 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative. She is coming to Carthage as a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow and speaking there in the Todd Weir Center later today at 6 p.m. with Carthage Professor Stephanie Mitchell. Nancy Tate, let's talk for just a couple of minutes about what occurred in the wake of that final ratification of the 19th Amendment, which, as you told us, finally took final form in the year 1920. So it will actually be next year that we can celebrate that moment when this was finally free and clear and the absolute law of the land. In the wake of the final completion and passage and ratification of the 19th Amendment, what can you tell us about women engaging then in the political process? How many women took up then the right to vote? I mean, exercised their right to vote in those first years, or was that a struggle as well to get people actually to the ballot box?
Yes, I'm going to answer your question in a minute, but I just want to go back and highlight the drama of what it took to pass in the last state. As I say, Tennessee was the 36th state, and a lot of the states, like Wisconsin, you know, ratified right away. But by the end, as they're getting close to 36, a lot of states were voting it down. I live in the state of Virginia, and Virginia declined. The state legislature defeated the amendment. So it wasn't as if, you know, this was easy sailing. It was a fight to the very end in Tennessee when one young state legislator switched his vote at the last minute, basically, and supported the amendment when he had been on record to oppose it. And that was the one vote needed, therefore, to switch the vote in Tennessee, and Tennessee was the vote needed to switch the amendment. So it is such an exciting, powerful story, and that man did that after receiving a letter from his mother who said, "Help Mrs. Cat put the rat in ratification." And he switched his vote, and that's how it all came to pass. So for anybody listening here who's really interested in reading some great drama about that last month or so, they should read the book The Woman's Hour by Elaine Weiss, because I believe Steven Spielberg is going to be making a limited series TV show about that over the course of next year.
Wow.
So you just, the drama of this, there's so much excitement, and it really conveys how tough it was and what all of these factors are. But the idea that one vote could make this much difference is just something that's so inspiring to the rest of us. Mm. But back to your question, it was a disappointment that the rush to get the amendment passed was so that women could vote in the 1920 election, which they did, but not in overly high numbers, not particularly. I mean, there was nothing astonishing about the numbers, which was, of course, a disappointment. On the other hand, there weren't very many months between August 26th and, you know, basically like November 5th to figure out how to, you know, register them and educate them and this and that. And so for whatever reason, there wasn't a lot of turnout. And there continued to not be a particularly high turnout of women, you know, for a number of decades after that. You know, it was certainly not higher than the men and often lower. But, of course, you went into the 1920s, and there's the Depression, and there's World War II. You know, all these things are happening. But by the 1980s, and I believe it was 1982, women's rate of registration and voter actual turnout has surpassed men's every year since.
Wow.
It took a long time. But, in fact, by now, it's well established that just the turnout numbers alone are greater.
Wow.
Of course, over that same time, slowly, you start to get more elected women. Now, actually, there was one elected woman who was already in the Congress of the United States before the amendment passed, because she was Jeanette Rankin, who was a congresswoman from Montana, because, you know, the people of Montana voted for her, and so she became one of their congresswomen. But, you know, typically that was, you know, highly unusual. So every once in a while there might be a woman at some point, but slowly over time. So it shows that, you know, men and women don't always just vote for people based on their gender, you know. So men can vote for women, women can vote for men. But over time we know that there's many more women in elected office at all levels, although certainly not at a 50-50 level. And over the same period, gradually, mostly because there are more, by the time there are more women in some of these elected bodies, you do start to see changes in the legislation, that where more policies that are reflect an orientation that might be important to women that had been not so important to men. And that's really been true, for instance, in some of the health research areas. So over time, there's been a big change in women's role in the electorate, but initially there really was not.
It's amazing, of course, to look at the number of women who chose to run for office in 2018. And I think most people would not argue with the fact that that had a great deal to do with the election results of 2016. But, I mean, astonishing numbers across the country. And more Democrats than Republicans, but lots of women from both parties and third parties, for that matter, and at every level of government life. I mean, from the national level all the way down to the local. I just wonder if you have any comment on what we saw in 2018, and if you think that is just the beginning.
Well, I don't have any more inside scoop on, you know, how everything is going to play out next year or in the years to follow than anybody else. But I seems unlikely that we're going to go backwards, at least anytime soon. I mean, of course, we know there's been other changes in society, and just the notion that women can have important public roles, that their voice can be heard publicly. I mean, that's the cultural aspect, which has lingered on in a much smaller way, but is there. And back when I was at the League, we would have different panels on this, and we would say, why aren't there more women running? Because there would be even more women in office if more women actually ran for office. And several of the experts would say, well, it takes a lot more to convince a woman to run in many cases. And they tend to come into the process later in their life than a lot of men do. For instance, Nancy Pelosi, who didn't even get active in politics until her 40s, because, you know, she had young children. So a lot of that is changing, and I think a lot more women are just getting more confident that they have something to say, and it's not only about, you know, women's issues, and they just feel more confident in being able to stand up and go for it. And I don't see that changing. I have no idea what the numbers of that would be. And, of course, I live here in Virginia where we're having a complete statewide election. Every Senate seat and every House of Delegates seat is up with a lot of women challengers and a lot of women incumbents, and, you know, we'll see. So it's I think the genie's out of the bottle, I guess, but exactly how it will play out over time will be affected, I'm sure, by lots of other factors as well.
Would you hope for the day when we wouldn't need organizations like the League of Women Voters, for instance? Or do you think there will, even in a world that is even more equitable than what we have now, would you still see a place for organizations like that?
Well, I would certainly see a place for the League of Women Voters, even if we can imagine a world where you didn't need any more reforms. It's pretty hard to imagine that world, but
yeah.
there were to be such a world, then maybe the League wouldn't need to do a lot of the advocacy work that it does. But the fact that there are, in most places, certainly here in Virginia, there are elections every year, particularly at the local level, it is very hard for citizens to keep up on, you know, on the candidates and the issues, and to have a trusted source of information. Because if you only listen to the TV ads, you know, or the online ads of two candidates, they're usually so vindictive about each other, among other things, you really don't have a very good sense about what either person stands for. So I think the League's role, even if it didn't need to have any more system reforms, which sadly we do, I think the sharing of information, bringing candidates together in debates, putting out voter guides where we explain the issues, and helping citizens register to vote. Because in this country, unlike almost every other advanced democracy, the burden of registering is on the individual. You have to go make an effort to get yourself registered. It doesn't just get sent to you in the mail. So, but if you're especially for people who are turning 18 for the first time, or newly naturalized citizens, how on earth would you know this? You know, where does it say what you have to do to register to vote? And the laws in each state are different, and the deadlines are different. So a very big role of the League is not only sharing candidate information, but sharing the rules of the election system where you live so that you will not be inadvertently disenfranchised because you showed up, you know, 10 minutes past when the polls closed, or you brought the wrong identification, or, you know, whatever. So I think that kind of trusted role in helping citizens enter into the election process is always going to be needed.
For sure. Nancy Tate is going to be speaking at Carthage today at 6 p.m. in the Todd Weir Center. She will be interviewed by Carthage faculty member Stephanie Mitchell. And this is a free event, open to the public. Registration is appreciated, and you can go to carthage.edu, click on the bridge, and find more information about that. Nancy Tate, I so appreciate your time, and thank you for sharing all of your expertise on this important issue. And enjoy your next few days at Carthage.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed speaking with you.